Today is the 15th day of April 2019. I'm interviewing Tom Pulteney, one of our very valuable people from the Knowledge Bank. Tom's going to tell us about his family and his life in Hawke's Bay. Tom?
Okay. My family moved to Hawke's Bay when I was 14. We came from Christchurch. Dad was changing jobs. He was a prison officer, and he got the job as Napier's superintendent, in charge of Napier Prison. So we moved up to Napier, 1966 it was. We came from Littleton to Wanaton on the Waini.
Did you? The new Waini, the one that sunk?
The one that sunk. Yeah, uh-huh. It was Littleton, Wellington both. So we came up on that one. I had started high school at Ricketton High School in Christchurch. When we got to Napier, I went to Boys High School. My younger sister went to Napier Intermediate at the time, and my older sister was still at school in Whanganui, just about to finish. My parents came to New Zealand in 1952. They were married in 1945, after the Second World War. Mum was a nurse during the war in a psychiatric hospital in London, so she went through the Blitz. Dad was an artillery gunner. So Dad was at Dunkirk, and he was evacuated to England 2 years later. Actually, I don't know what he was doing in those 2 years. He went to North Africa, Sicily, Italy. Yeah, I know he was at the Battle of Monte Cassino. He was with the 8th Army, so if anyone wants to know where he went, just follow the 8th Army. So, I don't know where he met Mum, but they got married in 1945 at the end of the war. I think they knew each other. Actually, I'm sure they knew each other because my younger sister found one of Mum's handbags a few months ago, and in it was a love letter from Dad. Wonderful year. So I'm sure they knew each other. My oldest sister was born in Tripoli in Libya. Mum was there, but Dad was stationed in Palestine. I don't think the women were allowed to go to Palestine with the men, so Dad used to fly over on leave to Libya. My younger sister was born in Libya. Then they went to Germany. I was born in Germany, in Munster. And in 1953, Dad handed in his papers and left the army, and they moved back to England. I've got photos of me sitting with my grandparents and one of my aunties, Mum's younger sister, who's still alive.
Is she really?
Yes, she's in her 80s, just about 90. There was a big age difference between Mum and the younger sister. And in 1954, they immigrated to New Zealand. So I was 18 months old when they came to New Zealand. I don't remember any. The first place I remember is Waikaria Prison. All the prisons in those days used to have housing for the prison officers near the prison. So the first place I remember is Waikaria. I started school at Kikikiki School, which is near Te Amitu. We got bussed over there and back. Actually, I went online not long ago, Google Earthed it, and stood on the street outside the school, and it still looked the same. Even the bus stop was in the same place. I think the buildings were newer buildings, but yes, they'd built it in the same, you know, long school. It was a long building. It was still the same. And yeah, I was quite surprised at that. But, you know, I had a walk around, like you can on Google Earth. The bus stop was still in the same place. I'm remembering the bus stop. And then we left there, and then transferred to Ringipo Prison. So we lived at Ringipo, right next to the National Park, for 2 years. So I went to Tongariro School in Turingi. While I was at Tongariro, my sister started high school at Whanganui Girls High, I think it was, boarding school. And then we moved down to Christchurch, where we were there, you know, a couple of years before we moved here to Napier. My sister was still at high school and finished high school, I think the year after we arrived in Napier, the older one. While we were down at Christchurch, at Paparua, there was a big riot there. I remember the prison burning. They set the prison on fire. Dad had to go in and rescue hostages, and that was in 1965. And he got awarded a British Empire Medal, BEM, for gallantry. He was awarded that and presented at the medal ceremony, you know, on a ceremony in 1966. So, I mean, we lived near the prison and we wandered around the countryside, but we never really interacted with prisoners. The only strange thing, I think, is all the parents in the streets that you lived in all did the same thing. They were prison officers. And that was a strange kind of childhood.
So then you moved to Christchurch?
From Rangipo, yeah. Yes. And then to Napier, of course. I got here and we lived in a house above the prison. Yes. You'd look out the window and you could see the beach. And in those days, there was plenty of swimming on the beach. There wasn't all the hoo-ha about it's dangerous or anything like that. They had a surf lifesaving club there. And I used to look down. I could see my friends on the beach. And, of course, I was off. I was down the hill, across the road, and going for a swim. Now, I loved it. I loved Napier. I really did. There was talk about Dad moving back to Christchurch, and I told him bluntly I wasn't going. No way I was going back down to Christchurch. No. I liked Napier. And actually, before anything came of it, Dad had a heart attack and died.
In Napier?
In Napier, 1969. Mum bought a house at it, Green Meadows, and I continued schooling until I left it. I was 18 when I left. I was a year behind in school, and they held me over a year when I was at Kikikiki. Put me a year behind. I had very bad eyesight, and they operated on my eyelids to lift them up out of the way. They've sunken again, but that improved things. Couldn't play rugby or sports like that. Yeah. Took off my glasses and I was hopeless. Anyway, when I left school, I was supposed to go in January or February, I can't remember. It was a few months away for an interview to join the forestry as a forestry worker. They were going to train me up. I wanted to go out of town and work because I'd lived away from cities in small villages and I wanted to get out of town. My young sister badgered my mother to tell me to get a job. My older sister actually was. So I found a job and I started working at Maria Hardware and Seeds for the Fergus family. And they were a great couple. They were really good to me. And the date for going out and joining the forestry came and went and I didn't go. When I was working at Maria Hardware and Seeds, his son Earl got me into rowing. So I joined the Hawke's Bay Rowing Club at Clive. And I was in the eights and the fours. I did give sculling a go, you know, the single rower, but I was hopeless at it and I really didn't like it. I finally left the club because there was not enough people to fill the eights or even a four, so I left. For a few years, you know, I bummed around, sort of just left home, went and lived in a flat, left the flat and went back home. Went to another flat, lived in another flat and went back home. The Fergus family, though, sponsored me to Outward Bound. I did go down to Outward Bound. I was about 19 or 20, and I was at the rowing club at the time. And I thought I was fit, but no. A piece of advice to anyone going to Outward Bound, make sure you are fit before you go. I remember getting there the first day, and we were split into four groups, you know, and then put on your first aid gear and go out and do calisthenics straight away. The push was so high, one guy was actually physically sick. So while we were in camp, it was calisthenics every morning in a 5 mile run or something like that. And then a cold swim in the sea. And it was cold. I mean, it was summer when we went, but it was still cold. And then we went sailing. This is the water we did it in. Then you had a group tramp in the ranges around the Melbourne Sounds where you learnt map reading and you had an instructor with you. Then we went rowing around the Sounds, you know, learned how to do it. And then we went sailing by ourselves. This is the order we did it. And if there was no wind, it was a cutter, you had to row it. So we had to row that because there was no wind. But the fastest we went when we were rowing it was when the tide was going out of Winchalot Sound. And the tide goes out there quite fast. We were supposed to sail out of Winchalot Sound to a rock pinnacle and then back inside to the Sounds. But we never got that far because for most of the time we didn't have wind. So we parked up on an island on the last night. It was a 3 day trip. And the next morning we sailed back and we had great wind. It went like a rocket the last day. And then we went for our tramp in the bush without the instructor. 4 days, I think that was. You had to find your way around 20 peaks in 4 days. Mm. So I think we reached 16 as a group. And we were up top on the range one night and it bucketed down. And I mean, it really rained. And the next night it rained again, but we had cheated. We'd come down out of the ranges and we were walking along. And we stopped by a farm and asked him if we could sleep in the barn for the night. And he took us down to a boat shed on the Sounds. And we slept in the boat shed. It bucketed down again. But when we went canoeing, there wasn't enough water in the rivers to kayak down the rivers. And we had to row around the Marlborough Sounds, down one sound, up another sound. And then we had to portage our canoes back over to Queen Charlotte Sound and row down to Howard Bend, which is at the end of Queen Charlotte Sound, across from Picton. Frank, you're right, we did spend a day in the bush, or overnight in the bush by ourselves. And in the morning we were supposed to tell them what time it was. They come to pick me up. It was night time when they picked me up. And asked me what the time was. I don't have a clue. Not allowed a watch, of course. Not allowed radio.
That's right.
You had to spend it by yourself. I think they checked up what I saw, because a man came round and sat in his boat and fished in the bay. I have my suspicions that they were checking up to make sure.
Yeah,
I think so. Physically, I found it a challenge. Mentally, well, it's supposed to build mental toughness as well. I suppose walking around 20 peaks in the bush when you only just learned to read a map is pretty challenging.
I know it's very expensive to go now, several thousand dollars.
I think it was expensive in those days. I didn't even think about it. That was, yeah, I'm not sure what year I went down. I was 19 or 20, so it was 71 or 72.
Sure.
I'm not quite sure. But it was fun, and the Fergusons were a great family. They were really good to me. But let's face it, working in a shop is not good pay, and I wanted more money. And I left there after a couple of years, and I worked in a wholesale electrical, and it was stationed in Carlisle Street, Nico. They were building the mill at the time. Right. Used to have truckloads of cabling go out from there.
You're talking about the mill at Furunaki? Yeah,
the paper mill at Furunaki, yeah, that is, yes. And, well, I wasn't really very good at doing that. And after 3 months, I was asked to leave. So I left straight away.
So when did you join the tannery then?
A day later. A friend of mine says, they're always looking for workers, Tom. Come over to Pacific Levers, or it was, yes, Cyrus Dales in those days. 10th Street and Pandora Industrial area. So I went over there, and I left on a Monday. I went over there on a Tuesday, and I started work on Wednesday. I had one day off, and I started as a machinist in the tannery, and within a month I was earning three times as much money as I was.
Makes a difference too, doesn't it?
It makes a difference, and, you know, bought a new car and all that sort of stuff.
What sort of car did you have?
I bought a Vauxhall, was it Crystal Velox? A Velox, yes. PB, which is a 3.3 straight six.
Quite a smart car.
A go fast. They were go fast. To me, a car with a big motor and...
Well, you were a big man.
Yeah, they would just go fast. They just go fast. But at that time too, I was still at the rowing club, and I was driving out there nightly for training. We used to go away on the rowing club. We used to go to Karapiro, Wairoa, Wanganui, Rotorua. To the national champs, I went twice. Karapiro was an interesting place because that was where you really got to see the Waikato team in those days, the best eights, I think, in the world.
When you look at the facilities they've got now, the buildings and that, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. And that was Waikato Club. And Waikato Club in those days, the eights, you watched them and it was incredible watching them. The boat was balanced. All the oars went into the water at the same time. They all popped out at the same time, and it was balanced. And they could make that thing really get up and move. It was beautiful to watch. And then, of course, they had the Olympics, where New Zealand won the gold medal for the eights. Avery Brundage was the Olympic Committee chairman, I think, and he presented the medal. I think he made quite a reference to, you know, what amateur sports did in those days. Anyway, yeah, I started working at the tannery, and I worked for about 3 years on a variety of machineries. I was a machinist. I was fleshing lamp pelts. It was a machine to peel the flesh off lamp pelts before you tan them. And then we used to do a job called wet wheeling, which is buffing the flesh off and making sheepskin suede. That's what the tannery was doing when I first started there, making sheepskin suede. And then Cyrus, which was an American company, sold their half of the company to Richmond's. and they started to tan cowhides and deer skins and started to expand the tannery. We had three tanning drums and they bought another tanning drum and we had expanded it to four. And I was still working on machinery. I did what they call splitting the hides, and we were doing deer skins, so I was doing deer skins as well.
Well, at some stage, Graham Lowe bought the company, didn't he?
Yes, that was only a few years ago.
Did you ever move to Coventry Road?
No, I never. I was always bugging them about joining the tanning department, and eventually they, I left machine work and went into the tanning department and worked in the tanning department. Studied for my leather diploma, which is a 3-year course. I found that very tough because by this time I'd met my wife, Pamela.
And been away from school for many years.
Yes, but not only that, I was working full time. We had two small kids, two children, and so, I was working 6-7 days a week sometimes and trying to do an assignment. We had 8 assignments a year and then an exam at the end of the year. An in-house course down at Massey at Lazaro, Liver and Tube Research Association. And it was, with all that going on, it was tough. I really struggled, I must admit, but I passed. In 1984, I got the job as tanning department supervisor, and I stayed on that job for 16 years.
Well, it was worthwhile getting your ticket, wasn't it?
It was worthwhile. It was still tough, though, being supervisor of the tanning department. It was running 24/7. I mean, it really was. I mean, the fact is, if the drums weren't turning, tanning something, they weren't making money. So they were always turning over. We didn't have a night shift on all night. We had 2 shifts.
You just let the machines run.
We just let the machines run, but they were on alarm system. So if something went wrong, then they'd go to the people that monitored the burger alarm as a plant failure.
Yes.
And they called up me and I went in. So, yes, I put up with that for 16 years. And at the end of 16 years, I was really burnt out. I really was. I asked if I could just go back down on the floor and be a worker again. And I shifted to the dry department where, when the levers come out, the retan and dyeing drums comes to be dried and finished. But I had an interest in life in the tannery. I mean, we did a lot of products over the years. I mean, we did moccasin shoe leather while it was popular. Those shoes were popular.
Yes.
We did clothing, nappa, for leather jackets. We did deerskin suede. There were a woman in Queensland who made deerskin suede coats that she sold to the tourists. We made motorbike leather. And we sold that to Jet Leathers and Hastings, they were one of our customers.
Yep.
Mostly we did shoe leather and upholstery leather.
So you really had a good look at the industry, didn't you?
I really did, yes. I was a machinist, tanner, back down on the floor again, and I guess you could call it a machinist again. And during that time, of course, I met Pamela, my wife. I met her through a friend. I became friends with this young man like me, I suppose, met at the pub, drinking buddies, interested in motorbikes. I had a motorbike, he was interested.
So what sort of motorbike do you have?
I had a Triumph 650. And he had a girlfriend, and he says, her sister's coming up to Napier to live. Why don't you ask her out? So I asked her out, Pamela, and that's how I met my wife. Now, Pamela had a baby daughter. She was 6 weeks old when I met Pamela. I had to sell the motorbike and buy a car because start going out and getting serious with a woman who's got a baby, you can't take her on a motorbike. So I sold the bike and bought another car because I'd sold my car earlier, my good car. And so I had to buy another car. In 1980 or 81, I think it is, we bought a house that was cheap on Hastings Street, needed a fix-up. It was a doer-upper, and during the time we were there, we pulled the wash house over and rebuilt the wash house out the back, put a new roof on it, ripped the windows out and put in aluminium windows. Totally redid the lounge room. And then we got to looking at the cost of doing it, and I was working, didn't have time, so we thought that the cost of getting it all done at once. The new kitchen, new bathroom, the outside painted, and the rest of the house decorated inside. And we got up to $50,000, and we thought, we're not going to get any money out of this with all the money we've already spent on it. So we sold it, and we bought in Foster Terrace because it was near Colenso High School. But we lived in Hastings Street for 15 years. It was a good start for us, and it was close to the beach. We went, you know, took kids swimming at the beach, and when they got older, we used to drive over to the West Shore and stop for an ice cream on the way home every time. We enjoyed, with the kids, we went bushwalking, and, you know, kids never, we never pushed them to do sport at school. They never did sport. When I had time in the weekend, I used to like going bushwalking or out and about with the kids, you know. At that time, my sister lived in Christchurch, and I remember in, it was 86, we drove down to Christchurch and visited my younger sister and visited her in Christchurch. My older sister lived in Palmerston North. We visited them quite often too. We never really toured around or had a caravan or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And when we went out, we usually went to family and stayed with family. Yes. We never stayed in motels. Cheap family life. Mum bought a house in Taradale, sold one up in Green Meadows and moved to a smaller place. And in, I think it was 89, she was getting on and having trouble. So she sold up that, and she moved in with my older sister, moved in with her in Palmerston North. So she went with Jane. Then Jane and Robin moved up to Tauranga. Mum moved up to Tauranga too, and she died in 1991. She was 73. So she'd been on her own for basically 20 years.
Yes.
Dad was 53 when he died. He was young. And they were born in the same year, 1915. So they're the same age.
So did you have your accident while you were working?
Yes, I was working in the dry department, and I was actually renovating my double bedroom. I was painting it, and I was at work. At that stage, I was either walking to work or biking to work. It wasn't very far away. It used to take me 37 minutes to walk to work, but that was my exercise. And I'd walk to work, but we only had enough work for half a day, so I was going to go home for lunch. I was going to quit by lunchtime, and I was going to come home and paint. So I rung up home, but I didn't get my wife, but my daughter was here with her two children. And she said, "I'll come pick you up, Dad." So she came to pick me up. She got there, and I said, "Where are the kids?" Because the kids usually came with her, you know, pick up Granddad. And she says, "One's watching television, the other one's playing computer games." Anyway, we were on the way home, and we were turning off Kel Tremaine Drive into Ford Road. My daughter was driving, it was her car. The truck came up behind us, and he was reading a report he'd just got from the way station, or filling out his logbook, something like that. And he didn't see us, and he ran to the back of the car at 70 kilometres an hour. He saw us at the last minute, swerved to avoid us, but too late. But it spun the car out across the road, and the car came the other way, hit the passenger side where I was sitting. I must have been out for a few seconds because I woke up with my daughter screaming. She was 23 weeks pregnant, and the seatbelt had jammed, and she was screaming, my baby, and she says, "I can't get the seatbelt undone." I reached across and grabbed the seatbelt and pulled it loose and says, "You'll have to push the button," because I says, "I think the bastard's broke my arm." And that's the last I remember until I was talking to a paramedic, and he was asking me, it was a she actually, that asked me what kind of meds I was on, you know, and I was telling her I was on blood pressure and all that sort of stuff.
What age were you then?
53. Yeah. And I woke up, Pam was there, and she says, "You've been in an accident." And I wanted to tell her I know that. I remember it. And she says, "You've been unconscious for 3.5 weeks. Now, if I'd been standing up, I think my jaw would have dropped to the floor. 3.5 weeks. It felt like I'd only been out for a few minutes. It makes a black hole. For a long time, I was walking around with 3.5 weeks missing and wanted to know what the hell had happened, what I'd missed in those 3.5 weeks. Anyway, yeah, it was quite major. My daughter was okay. More shock than anything. The
baby all right?
Baby was okay. She's now 12.
So how long were you in hospital and recuperating?
I was in the hospital for 5 weeks. I was supposed to go down to physio ward, but they didn't have any room, and I wanted to go home, so they sent me home. And I was supposed to drive out to Hastings every day to have physio, but apparently the woman who was supposed to teach me wasn't as ACC accredited, so I couldn't go out there. So I ended up going to an ACC accredited place in Napier, a physio place in Kennedy Road, I can't remember the name of it. And I was on physio for a year, and it was 6 months until I was strong enough to go back to work. But in the accident, my shoulder had been broken, my shoulder blade had been broken, all the ribs on my left side had been broken, some of them in two places, not just fractured, broken. I had a punctured lung on the left side which collapsed, and they had to do the old stick the needle in them. I also had two fractures in my back. One was a fracture which can mend, and the other one was a crush fracture, and that's at L2 right down the bottom, and they tell me crush fractures never heal. I am lucky I'm still walking, and not only lucky I'm still walking, but lucky I don't have chronic back pain. Now and again it gets sore and pain, but not very often. I think I am very lucky where the back's concerned, but my shoulder gives me constant pain. And if I do physical work, I'm only good for 2 or 3 hours. Ribs give me so much pain that if I keep going, so they'll put me on the floor.
So when did you learn computerisation? Was that at work?
Well, computerisation. I bought my first computer in 1984. It was an Atari.
Never heard of it.
No, there was a lot of computers around in those before IBM and Microsoft became popular. There was a lot of brands. It was Commodore computers, Seagate, I think it was, Atari. And so I bought a computer. I thought these were the upcoming things. I bought it for the kids. And then I hogged it. And at the same time as I was made supervisor of the tanning department, they automated the tanning drums, but they automated them with a punch card system. These punch cards were about 2 metres long. And what you did is you opened the door on the front of the punch card panel, and you push the card in, and it slid down, and then they had a curve in it to make it come back up, and it had a curve in the top, so you push it down, and the end of the card was right where the beginning of the card was, and it had motor driven, they had holes inside the cards, and you had a V-shaped cut, and you pushed it very gently up over them. There was 40 micro switches behind the card, and you pushed it very gently up. And on the punch card was all the information. It's called a punch card because you punched holes in it. There was a machine there. You pushed a pedal and pushed a punch down. It was 5 millimetres long.
Yeah.
So you had to put all this information on that punch card with this pedal. It had 40 tracks. Each track did something different. So there was timers, drum forward, drum backwards, drum speed, you know, chemical addition from the batch tank to the drum. Send a signal over to the protomix, which weighed out liquid chemicals, sent it to the batch tank, put in water to the drums. It was magic, but the trouble was, my job was to make these punch cards. Oh. Being supervisor of the tanning department, I had to make it. So what I did is I got the recipe for each process, you know, and I wrote out a program to make the punch card, so I'd have it in front of me. So I'd do step one, then step two, and I had a slide that slid under the step, you know, step three. Mm. And I wrote out all these recipes at home on the Atari, and I pinched the paper from work and printed it out at work, you know, from paper from work at home on an old dot matrix machine. So I had this information sitting in front of me. And that way I could make all the punch cards the same.
And you could do it without pushing.
Well, you had to. What you do is you slide the card into the punch card maker and it slid over like that. And then you had a hole, which were numbered, where you pushed a pin. Mm. And that was the track number you wanted corresponding with that pin. You pushed the pedal down and it punched a 5 millimetre hole. So if you had a long, you know, you had three timers. There was a timer which moved the card at 5 millimetres a minute, right? Then you had a timer that was 2 minutes, and then you had a timer that was half an hour. So if you were timing something at 5 millimetres a minute. You give it one punch or so, then you move it and punch it again, and then you move it.
But once you got it on the computer, that would simplify things a lot.
Yes, we converted the punch card machine. A very clever man called Alan Cooper from Falcon Electrical says, I can computerise that. And I says, please give it a go. So what we did, where the punch card was, there was a big plug. They had 40 pins in the course. So we put that plug, or he did, in a box of relays. So the box of relays were switched on and off through that pin. So the relays took the places of the micro switches. But the relays were activated by the computer. So you now had a chip in a box, 40 chips instead of 40 switches. Yeah. You activate each chip by the computer. So we now had a computer activating, what, taking the place of the relays and activating the chips and taking the place of the micro switches in the punch card. And then you should just write a computer program to...
So that would have been quite...
Well, it was quite time-saving because you only had to put the recipe in once. We had 8 tanning drums by that time and one computer controlling the whole lot. When the tanners wanted to put in the recipe, they just came over and said what drum they were using, selected the recipe they wanted, then they went over to the machine, to the panel where the punch cards used to be, and turned it to auto and pushed start. And that started the computer running that recipe.
That must have been a real saver.
Oh, it was a real time saver. The trouble was then that I was the supervisor of the tanning department, but I didn't make any of the recipes. The man who made the recipes then decided, I can do lots of experiments now. I can change the lemon tanning the recipe as much as I like because it's computerised. It won't take much to change the recipe.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time changing recipes, but it was good. And by that time, you know, the old places got computers anyway. I mean, they sent me on a computer course to study Microsoft Office and spreadsheets and typing programs. And I also had to learn, you know, time management and all that sort of thing. And we did actually a lot of work, supervisors.
Well, someone has to keep the ship going in the right direction.
So, yeah, and also we did 9001 ISO, and we wrote a program how to train people and a job breakdown for every job and train people with using this manual.
So you really were a tanner machine operator right through, weren't you?
Yeah, and I really got into computers. I wish I'd left the tanning and studied IT and become a computer guy. I like computers. I like playing with them. I'm not so interested in gaming on computers or social networking. Yeah. I like computers that you can do work with. Even though I had the Atari at home, my primary introduction to computers was the punch card system, which really was a computer, even though a basic one, and then computerising that.
So how long did you stay on tanning?
Well, I was a tanner after I stopped machine work. 28 years I was in the tanning department. I could have left and gone to other tanneries. I mean, I was offered jobs, but some of the jobs were, it's not so much the job as where they were. Like, I was offered one job where they built a freezing works out in the Australian outback, and next door they built a tannery, and it's like, do you want to work in a tannery in the middle of the bloody outback? I mean, you know, the nearest town was 200 miles away.
Yes.
I mean, miles, not kilometres. And besides the one that was there where the freezing works was obviously in that.
So did you retire from the tanneries?
Well, I stopped work at the tanneries. I tried to go back to work tanning after the car accident or working in the dry department. But quite honestly, the physical work was too painful. I had so much damage that if I did physical work, my ribs started to hurt. And let me tell you, I couldn't work through it. I mean, if I kept going, the pain would get so bad I would be lying on the floor. I was on AC3 for 3 years after I finished at tannery. I finished in 2007. The car accident was in 2006 in July. I finished in 2007. I just couldn't do the work.
And so you came home?
I came home and I sat around for 3 years. I was kicked off ACC and went on to invalid's benefit because I really couldn't do anything. A friend of mine who worked at Hawke's Bay Hides says to me, Tom, we need a temporary lab technician. And so I went over there and I knew what tanning was all about. I hadn't worked in the lab, but they trained me what to do. The lab technician over there was a woman and she was pregnant and she was taking time off and I was supposed to be there for 6 months. She left to have a baby, came back to work, was there 2 weeks and left.
Left you holding the baby.
And left me holding the baby. And even that job, even though it was not hard physically, at the end of the day I was screaming in agony. My ribs were killing me. The pain in my ribs has never gone away. And I said to him after 11 months, I says, I can't continue to do this. And they found someone else to take it over. And I left and I never worked again. Then in 2013, my wife belongs to the Lions organisation in Napier. We went on a mystery bus trip around Christmas time, or December it was. And we ended up at Stonycroft. Having a tour of Stonycroft and James Morgan giving us a talk and telling us about the history of Hawke's Bay and the history of this house and how the Hawke's Bay Digital Archive was getting people's records together and they were going to digitise them and they needed volunteers to digitise them. I was at home at this time, of course, not doing anything. And I thought, this is really light work, I could do this. So I put my name down and I started as a volunteer in 2014, January, when they went back from the Christmas break, and I've been out there ever since volunteering at Hawke's Bay Digital Archive. I only work in the morning. I still get pain in my ribs. Most of the time I go out to Hastings. I go out by bus. I get off at the hospital and walk down to Stonycroft and then I leave about 11:45 and I walk back down to the hospital and get on the bus. Comes at 10 past 12. And a lot of times I get to the hospital and I'm pretty sore. Mm. I have to ring up Pam and say, pick me up.
Have you always had an interest in photography?
No. James put me on the camera and I had to learn about photographing documents. He says, you can do the camera. I don't know anything about cameras. So this camera is an OBD camera that's hooked to a computer. You turn on the camera, you turn on the computer program, and it's called a tethered camera. And you have a lights shining on a table, called a light table, for obvious reasons. And then you open live view on the camera by this computer program, the tethering program. You focus on what, you know, zoom in and out to the page you want to photograph, and photograph the page. Or if people have got big portraits that can't be scanned, too big to be scanned, we photograph them too. But mainly the reason we photographed them is because they're too big to fit on the scanner. So we photographed them.
Pam, obviously, has been very supportive of you working away at
Stonycroft.
Yes.
I think she was more supportive of me going out to Stonycroft to get me out of the house. So I was at home. So what year did I leave Hawke's Bay Hides, where I worked for a year as a lab technician? I left there in 2012. So I'd been at home for a couple of years doing nothing. I was going nuts. I really was. You don't go out. You don't see anyone. No. You don't interact with anyone. No. I think a requirement to anyone retiring is make a plan of what you're going to do. You've got to do something or you will go nuts. And so, yes, Pamela kicks me out of the house if I say I'm not going. She says, yes, you are. Pamela is great. We've been married since, when did we get married? 1976, what's that, 40 odd years. Yeah.
So how many grandchildren have you got?
Well, I've got three children, Alicia, the oldest, Penelope and Andrew. Andrew's got three children, Alicia's got three children, Penny hasn't got any children. So that's Harley, the oldest, Crystal, Lexa, they are Alicia's children, and then Tiffany, Marcus, and Daniel. Now, Crystal is a young woman now, and she's got a child, so I've got a great-grandchild as well. Andrew lives in Australia, in Newcastle. He's a chef, a head chef of a restaurant in Newcastle. I don't know the name of it. I don't bother to find out the names of the places he's working. He shifts jobs so often. He's had more jobs than I ever had.
I think it's a fairly volatile area.
Yeah, I think it is. But he's doing very well. I mean, he's an executive chef, that's the word I'm looking for. And he's on, well, good money in Australia, more than he could in New Zealand. My youngest daughter works for the ANZ Bank in Wellington, and my oldest daughter in Auckland works for the post office.
All good jobs.
My son Andrew, he gets more than double what he'd get in New Zealand. I've been over to Australia, and the rent they pay is no more than in New Zealand. No. The food, I find, is cheaper, and they make more money, so they're better off. And they have compulsory super. I would love my son to come back to live in New Zealand so I could be closer to him, see him more often, see my grandchildren.
Is he like you?
What do you mean? I suppose he looks like me, but he doesn't have red hair. I haven't got red hair anymore, but I used to be a redhead. And I think I had a redhead's temper, as they call it. I was pretty volatile. I don't know, I think I've slowed down over the years.
So what else have you got on that sheet for me?
Nothing, I think we're finished. You could talk forever though, Frank, but I think we've covered the high points.
You've given me a fairly good brush stroke of your life and of your family and what you've done, what you've achieved at Pacific Leathers.
Yeah, now a volunteer, but one thing I like being a volunteer, if you have to go somewhere, all you have to say is, sorry I can't, and you just go. Yeah. I mean, this year already I've been down to Wellington, been up to Auckland, and I wanted to drive down State Highway 1 from Auckland to Wellington, which I've never done, so I did that. Tried to do it all one day, but we got down to Foxton. Pam's brother lives in Foxton. It was another hour and something trip, and we'd been on the road 7 or 8 hours, so it's time to stop. We stopped in Foxton and said hello to him and stayed overnight.
Okay, well, I think we've probably got most of it.
Thank you, Frank.
That's all right. It's my pleasure. And Tom, thank you for your contribution to the Knowledge Bank and the work you do, because you've become a bit of a specialist there.